are about to go here. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I am Phil Taylor. And by the way, you can reach us, taylor-report.com. And you can always write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. And some of you are kind enough to do that. And with me is Phil Conlon.
Good afternoon.
How are you, Phil?
I'm doing good.
We're going to be talking this afternoon, and it'll be at 5:30 with another half hour with Stephen Gowans. That would be gowans.wordpress.com. He's always a welcome guest because Stephen is a very clear writer, always very reasonable, and always skeptical about the way the capitalist system operates. And he's so we look forward to his comments because there's been an election in Zimbabwe, and once again, the ruling party under Robert Mugabe has been victorious, and once again, the media of Canada, the United States, France, Britain is unanimous. They don't like the results. They have a favorite guy there and a favorite party, and he hasn't been able to get over the top of the mountain, but they keep trying, and they also keep being skeptical and trying to toss cold water on Robert Mugabe and his leadership in Zimbabwe. Now, I worked in East Africa, our listeners will know. I worked in Tanzania, and one of the pleasures of that work was that I got to read the daily media from Nairobi and Dar es Salaam and all up, and actually across Africa. One thing I noticed was that all this wall and noise, I mean, it's almost a Phil Spector scene of wall-to-wall sound of how could they ever, and Robert Mugabe is no good, and blah, blah, and these policies have destroyed the economy. All that sound is not apparent in Africa. And I recall being in Arusha, Tanzania, at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda and reading my papers as well as going to court. And the West had, this was the previous election, and the West was very unhappy at the previous one. And then on that occasion, they had decided that they would see if they could pressurize the situation and force Mugabe out. And so, and the way they were doing it was to call on all the leaders of the region, but particularly Tanzania, South Africa, Zambia, Kenya. These states were called upon to go and meet with Robert Mugabe and explain to him he had to go. That was how the New York Times saw it. That was how Le Monde, I guess they must have seen it. Don't ever be taken in by that bunch of crooks. Anyway, Le Monde and others, and certainly the Ottawa Citizen and the Globe, I'm sure, they all said, well, you know, Robert's got to go. And our friends there, or those who accept our presence and domination and want to borrow money from us or want us to come and invest, they have to go and tell Robert to go. And so a meeting was initiated, and my memory is it was the president of South Africa who convened a meeting with Robert. And it was in Dar es Salaam, I believe. And we were all to wait breathlessly while they all went in, and the pictures of them all going in. And so I saw the pictures in East Africa when they all came out. And they all came out, and they were doing something you don't see Western leaders do. They were holding hands, which, by the way, that's something I had to get used to. In East Africa, you know, if you like people and men, they take your hand as a sign of their friendship. And so there they were, as Robert Mugabe holding hands with the leader of South Africa, and he had his holding hands with the leader of Tanzania. And I didn't see that picture. You know, when I also checked the Western press, not so much. And they all said, well, we had a nice talk with Robert, and he's a nice fellow. And he agrees with us that we all appreciate democracy. And by the way, I mean, try to picture this. Robert Mugabe looking into the eyes of his fellow Africans who've been part of a struggle as he was, and he was a leader of the actually bloody contest with colonialism, where thousands of Africans got hanged. On this program, we interviewed a former British soldier who talked about hanging Africans, the followers of Jomo Kenyatta. He saw it happen, and they were tortured, they were starved, and they were imprisoned. They would come to a village and they'd say, "We're not just imprisoning the local political leader. All of you are in prison. We're building a fence around your village. And by the way, you're probably going to be a little short of food and water and medicine." That was the way they played. And Robert Mugabe was one of the people who resisted. And he has, as they say, he's got cred, you know. And so when these guys came and talked with him, I mean, none of them could say, "You know, Robert, my country is better than your country. My country is more democratic." He would say, "Oh, really? Can I ask you something?" And because each of them, I mean, these are real people, you know, and they all know each other, and they have mutual respect. The other thing they have is Africanness. They know about the IMF and the World Bank, and they know all that stuff. So that was the reality. And there was foot stomping and disgust expressed, you know, that the Africans would... not do as they were asked to do and tell Robert he had to go. But Robert doesn't have to go. The other thing that Robert Mugabe has done, and we're going to be talking later with Stephen Gowans at length about this election, is that, of course, we know that he made the decision that the land had to belong to Africans, that those who had lost their land to the colonialists had a right to claim it back, and the government negotiated all that. They didn't take, by the way, the rich farms and all that, but they made land available that had been the white farmers had taken and had been reinforced by British rule. Now, when Zimbabwe became independent, part of the process was that the British government, in order to have good relations with the new Zimbabwe and with Robert Mugabe, they said, "We will contribute to compensating anybody whose land it becomes necessary for the government to take in order so that African farmers, Zimbabwean farmers, can have good land," by the way, as opposed to just a piece of sand, real land, the British government would help. But when, after a number of years, the question kept coming up. Incidentally, the question keeps coming up in South Africa. And so two countries, the question was coming up. What about that land? And so Robert Mugabe's party decided, okay, the time has come, and we're going to do it. That was the moment he went from being nice Robert to becoming, bad. He must be a voodoo Maoist or something, and something had to be done. Well, of course, African leaders going to tell Robert not to do that would make it awfully hard to go home, right? If you visit Zimbabwe and say, "Robert, you have to give that land back to the white farmers," and then you go back to South Africa, there might be a few black farmers there waiting at the airport saying, "What did you tell Robert to do?" So that's where the squeeze is what are we going to do about this? And so we have the following headline from Bloomberg, and this is what we will be at 5:30 talking to Stephen Gowans about, gowans.wordpress.com if you want to warm up on this subject. The title is "Zimbabwe to Seize Mines While Compensating Banks." And it begins that President Mugabe's government plans to seize control of foreign-owned mines without paying for them as part of a program to accumulate $7 billion of assets following his July 31 election victory, a minister said. By the way, Bloomberg isn't very enthusiastic about this. You notice the words "seize"? By the way, you big rich companies, how did you get that land? But actually, the minister says, makes it very clear, and it quotes the minister, actually. He says, "When it comes to natural resources, Zimbabwe will not pay for her resources." Because they belong to, guess who? Zimbabwe. Kasu Kukweri said, if they don't want to follow the law, that's their problem. I mean, he sounds like Trudeau. People don't remember Trudeau Elder. We had a struggle here at one point about who, whether 51%, or, you know, could a foreign company come and have, how much could they control? And the Canadians all said, no, we agree with Trudeau. You know, they can't just walk away. So that's how radical it is that radical. But it's when it's an African, to say black African, then it becomes like somebody's nightmare on Wall Street. Is it, they say what is perfectly reasonable. So this phenomenon is happening. Now, if Robert is Mugabe, I like to call him Robert, if he's going to continue this road, others will have to follow. And we know that in South Africa today, the question of land is a burning question. That's why everybody talks about everything else. It's kind of like, oh golly, let's talk about the Paralympic champion who shot his wife, our girlfriend, or let's talk about whether beaches will be opened up to everybody, and what happened, what about the gated communities that only seem to have one group of people in them, and that kind of stuff. But they don't want to talk about the land, and they certainly don't want to talk about those minerals and precious metals. Robert Mugabe has created an interesting dilemma, and if frankly, I don't see any other word for it except he's providing leadership, and perhaps that would be the reason that there was an election in Kenya, in which the son of Jomo Kenyatta was elected, despite the fact that the International Criminal Court called him on the carpet and said, "Oh, you know, we think you are bad fellow, so that we can prevent you from holding office in your own country." The people of Kenya seem to react to the decision of the International Criminal Court by saying, "We like him. You got anybody else here you don't like? Because we'll vote for them too." So this is what's going on. Actually, throughout those countries, we're seeing a political struggle. We could call it a national and class struggle going on. And Robert Mugabe is providing leadership. People make fun of him. He's 91 years old or whatever. He said, well, as long as the colonists stay, try to come back, I'm going to be here. He said, he knows they like to mock him. I would say, so long as his speeches are as reasonable as the ones he's been giving, everybody should not be surprised he's popular. But at any rate, and Stephen Gowans has analyzed the recent election. He says that unquestionably Mugabe won that election, and he's going to prove it for us by citing the documents provided by even such people as the CIA. I mean, if you can't believe the CIA, who can you believe? You're listening to the Taylor Report at CIUT 89.5 FM. And Phil Conlon is here. And Phil, we will come back to Gambia a little later, or Zimbabwe, but I want to ask you, last week on this show, we spoke to Harry Glasbeck, Professor Emeritus, York University, and there is some details that we didn't entirely get into, I'd like you to speak to again or to clarify. It's a grisly detail, the first one. The train with 73 cars and, as you say, no crew, was parked in west of Lac Megantic, 11 miles away, I guess. And it wasn't put on a siding. Why?
I think because putting it on the siding and properly locking it down, you would have needed more crew. Or the guy going off duty would have spent a couple of hours doing it. And
whose decision would it be to do that?
Oh, that's the operations, the superintendent of operations.
It's not the engineers.
No, absolutely not. The engineer.
They told him where to put it.
A railway engineer has less freedom with what he does than a prisoner in a penitentiary. He has train orders that tell him everything he does from the time he arrives at work to the time he books off. You go this speed at this place, you stop for this light, you pull into the siding to let this guy pass you. He has no discretion in how he does his job. And actually, if he ever thinks he does, he usually loses his job.
You know? Well, by the way, wouldn't that be... I suppose from a safety point of view, you think, well, that's good, except unless there's a company policy to put it on the main line. Am I using the right language?
Leave it on the main line. Yeah. You know, I mean, there's a couple of things you can do. You can put it in the siding. You can use the low-tech solution of putting a derail block in front of the train. That probably would have prevented it from making the initial, it might have been a puff of wind that got it moving, right? Because if it's on a downhill. But also common sense, like ordinary physics tells you, you don't leave a train where it's long enough that either at the back end or the front end, because it could roll backwards too, the force of inertia, which is something you learn in high school about the force of inertia, can take over and get things moving, right? Which you know, may be what happened here. I think it's likely what happened here.
Well, it was on an incline.
It was on an incline. So, you know. Yes. I mean, even if you didn't finish your high school physics class, you should know that, right?
Yeah, because if you ever had a little car and you put it on something and rolled away from you.
Absolutely.
Or a marble. I mean, people, I was very good at marble.
People know that. You know, I don't want to speculate as exactly what happened because I don't know.
Well,
I
mean, can you tell us what from your years' experience, are they usually put on sidings? And if not,
well,
why not?
Sometimes trains can be left on the main line, but if they are, they're not left there for a great. I mean, the railway I worked for, you can't leave them there very long because you need the main line for other trains. But usually, you know, because another crew's coming on in an hour or two and stuff like that. There didn't seem to be another crew here. There seems to be like they was going to sit there for 8 or 10 or 12 hours. And if it's a railway that doesn't have a lot of traffic, if there's no trains due for another 24 hours, I suppose it in one sense it's not going to interfere with train operations. But it doesn't make it a safe practice if it starts to move, it then, you know, can just take off, you know, as far as it can go, right? Again, if you're on a siding, they have derails on sidings, or sometimes the siding is aimed at the ditch. And I think, Phil, we talked about once that, you know, there's highways in the western United States.
Yes, outside Salt Lake City.
Right, which they call the runaway truck lanes, right? Where if you're going downhill and you realize your brakes can't stop your truck, you go into this lane and it's soft and you have a soft landing.
Well,
right?
you run into gravel.
That's right. I mean, usually when a railway accident like this happens, it's because four or five things went wrong. And, of course, the big capitalist there, he made up his mind within 24 hours. Well, the engineer did it, you know. Well, maybe the engineer did do something wrong. I don't know. Maybe he did. Maybe he didn't.
But when you have that many problems built into it.
You need a lot of other things to go wrong as well. That's my point.
And update us on this. Do you know any... now, as we said, speaking to Harry Glasbeck last week, the subject came up of... he says he turned his pockets out. Says, "Well, I don't have the money to pay for the cleanup."
What do you know about that? Well, there's an interesting story about that too. Railways buy insurance. Either they buy insurance, or if they're big enough, they can self-insure because they've got the cash reserves.
Now he's telling us the insurance company can't pay.
Well, the insurance
or won't.
Well, it's not the insurance company won't. It's the guy didn't buy enough insurance. He bought enough insurance to cover a small incident and stuff like that, but he didn't buy enough insurance to cover this type of an incident. And yet this is not the first time in history that this type of an incident has happened. And the interesting thing is, it appears, again, I'm referring to an article in this morning's Globe and Mail, that the federal agency that regulates railways has to sign off on your insurance to have your operating license. Show us your certificate of insurance. Show us that you have adequate insurance in case something goes wrong. Now, somebody in that agency, if they were not asleep at the switch, to use a railway term, would have looked at it and said, given the commodity that you carry and given that we're giving you permission to operate with these stripped-down crews, we think you need more insurance. But they didn't do that. They said, sure, $25 million is fine. And the reason why the insurance company won't pay for the cleanup is because... what they're saying is that they're holding that money in reserve for the personal liabilities for the families and stuff like that, which of course is a popular thing to say, and that might even be true. I mean, ultimately the insurance companies will pony up $25 million, but that's it and that's all, because that's all they signed on for. That's right. Mm-hmm. And you have now, I mean, they're throwing around figures like $200 million. And personally, I think Stephen Harper and the Tories should pony up for it, because they're the ones who put this regulatory regime in place that allowed this guy to do this, right? They're the ones who told him it's okay to operate with a one-man crew. I call it a no-man crew. They're the ones who told him it's okay to run that commodity through this beat-up track. That's another thing about the Montreal, Maine, and Atlantic. You read all the press reports, they're consistent. Every town along the way that they go into and they talk to the local people, they say the track is in terrible condition and the trains always crawl through here. The fact that the trains are always crawling is a symptom of the fact that that the track is no good. And there was a former railway engineer who writes a column in the U.S. and he said, I understand a 15 mile an hour limit. I understand a 10 mile an hour limit. He says, I don't understand a 5 mile an hour limit. He said that track.
Well, he said he understood it in one way.
Well, one way, of course.
It's a confession. The track is so bad.
It's so bad that you
it's practically ought not to be used. By the way, please, we'll produce on air. Please follow his opinion, because this is a guy who's obviously watching.
He's
opened issues. And naturally, we want to be responsible about it. There's like, for example, the fracking issue of the are there chemicals that cause that to be so combustible?
And by the way, they're keeping their mouth shut on that question.
The
people in North Dakota are not being forthcoming on that question.
No one's saying a thing. You have to watch that very closely, because you understand we have fracking now. They have fracked us good. You know how people say, don't frack with me? Well, boy, they are fracking. Yeah. And if they are using, see, unfortunately, this would open up a whole bunch of arguments which they don't want to hear about, because they're committed to fracking across the board.
And by the way,
practically every major state has got an issue with fracking.
And by the way, Quebec is a frack-free zone right now.
We
have nuclear-free zones that federal governments ignore, now we have a frack-free zone.
People forget that one of the reasons people voted for the Parti Québécois was that she said there won't be any fracking. Yeah. And she was living by it, so it's a horrible tragedy to have this happen by coming from a place where that's what they're doing.
That's right. Well, I mean, in a sense, Quebec got fracked. You know, it's absolutely
It's an ugly situation, and we're going to track the frack, as it were. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT, 89.5 FM, and at 5:30 we're going to be talking to Stephen Gowans to analyze the Zimbabwe elections, but also to get into a subject which I know is dear to Stephen's heart, which is the right of the Zimbabwe people to their own resources, and which according to Bloomberg, Western capitalist powers are not too happy about. So we'll be doing that. I want to tell everybody that, you know, we do this, this is the 200th, if I got the right, 200th anniversary of the Anglo-American War, which began in June of 1812, and various things have been going on in that war, so this is now the 200th anniversary of the fighting that was taking place this time of year in 1813. Something dramatic happened in Lake Ontario. A major British ship was trapped by the Americans in the Hamilton, well, I guess we call it harbor. And so they were watching and besetting, trying to catch this ship. By the way, the captain of that ship, he was the guy in charge of the whole operation in the Great Lakes, the British commander. And on August 8th, two American ships who were involved in that were hit with a squall at 2 in the morning. And they were turned over and sank. One of them was called the Hamilton, strangely enough. The other one was called the Scourge. And we took an interest in this, in talking about the fighting of 1812 between the British and the Americans. And because the Scourge had been part of the capture of Fort York, and aboard that ship was an interesting sailor whose name was Ned Myers, and he was from Halifax, and he was the bastard son of a British Army officer. And happily for history, Fenimore Cooper, the American novelist, knew him. They had been in the Navy together, and so Ned Myers was aboard the Scourge, and he told his story and was published under the the magical name of Fenimore Cooper. And by the way, it's interesting how we can, as time goes by, we patronize authors, and so we don't read them because we think that somebody said something snide about them, you know, and therefore we're all like sheep. We agree with the snide point without ever reading the author. I was, D.H. Lawrence had very high opinion of Fenimore Cooper. One of the reasons he wanted to go to New Mexico when he came, and to Mexico itself, is that he was affected by Cooper's account of Native Americans. So anyhow, he knew Ned Myers, and so Ned Myers was able to tell us what happened aboard the Scourge. And when they were here in April of 1813, the Scourge, about 10% of the crew were black. They were freemen. They were black sailors. And he was operating a gun, shelling Fort York, and the operators of the gun were called the Black Jokers. There were five guys. They're very, according to the captain, they were outstanding. And so I thought, well, it's interesting to follow what happened to them, as well as there was a black cabin boy. Myers estimates his age at 10 or 11. Anyway, they all were drowned on August the 8th, 1813, off Hamilton. And if you were to sail 10 miles due north of St. Catharines, the two ships are lying at the bottom there. But since we know something about the crew members, it's interesting to imagine something about them or to look in further into it. How did they happen to be there and all that? Myers was fortunately above deck at the time that it was just a squall. And neither of the two ships, the Scourge or the Hamilton, were really designed for warfare. They had been converted. So you put a cannon, several cannons on the deck of a ship, and then a squall comes. It can flip over, which is exactly what happened. There is a historical society. You can look it up, Hamilton and the Scourge, and it's been visited by divers. These two ships have been visited by divers. So anyway, that's something we have to know. And then the other 200th anniversary point is that the right wing of the British Army, when I say right wing, I'm talking about the front, the battle front. They were on the below Lake Erie in Ohio, suffered defeats in July and August, attempt to capture American forts in Ohio, which was the key battle for the so-called Northwest Confederacy of Native Americans led by Tecumseh and a gentleman named Roundhead and some others. Split Log was also a big figure there. Now, they tried to capture the forts, Fort Meg and Fort Stevenson. 1,400 members of the British Army were also present, and I shouldn't say also present. They were leading the attack, but they failed. And we have to note that, because this is August 1813, 200 years ago. That was the end of the line for the native allies of the British, because at that point, the British made their decision to call off the offensive and to withdraw. At the end of August 1813, a battle took place in Lake Erie, which came out badly for the British. They lost their ships, which meant that that was the end of the line for the previous success at Detroit and elsewhere. It also was very fateful, absolutely fateful, for the Ohio struggle of Native Americans. And unfortunately for them, at the urging of the British, they had torn up their treaties with the Americans to go to war. And the consequence was going to be that if they lost the war, they would lose any claim they had in Ohio, which is why when they had to withdraw from Detroit and had to head up the Thames River towards Hamilton again, Burlington, when they did that, it was all over for their claims, because when the peace agreements were struck at Ghent, the British totally threw out the political demands of the native leaders. And, of course, Tecumseh lost his life, but at that point it was all over anyway. It was terrible. And he had half his command had been lost when the British Navy lost Lake Erie. that was the end of Tecumseh's authority over his forces. Half of his forces refused to follow the British towards Burlington up the Thames River. They said, no, we're not going. You've already abandoned us. We've lost Ohio. I mean, now our best hope is that we can negotiate something separate, which they did. They then met with Governor Harrison from Ohio, and he signed a new agreement with them. And poor Tecumseh, of course, came to a bad end, as it were. Anyhow, this seems relevant. It's the 200th anniversary. We're going to take a break, I believe, and then we will be back with Stephen Gowans.